it is Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, there was no Brokenomics last week, and I did record one, but the sound file got corrupted, and so I'm having to re-record it, which is desperately upsetting for me because I'm talking about one of my least favourite subjects, which is Gary's economics, a troubling individual who is so certain of himself, despite being so wrong. Now, I did a segment on the podcast about this, and I thought I explained as clearly as I could in the space of 20 minutes and crosstalk and all the rest of it, why he's wrong. And I might have called him a chimp a few times. And there were lots of comments, presumably from Gary's supporters, because he has got lots of them, saying, oh, these are just ad hominem attacks, and you know, you're not really dismantling his argument and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so I thought, fine, I'll do a proper Brokenomics and I will properly dismantle what he's saying. Now, there were lots, I mean, he puts out lots of content, but what I'm particularly picking on, if you wanted to see my source material, was this debate that he did on, I think it was Diary of a CEO. It's in the reading links. Hopefully my editor can flash up the video. But he did a debate with this chap and he was utterly dismantled. And I thought, I'll watch that, I'll go through it and I'll pick out all of the areas where he is, well, every time he speaks, he's wrong. So, but I thought I'd describe clearly why wealth taxes don't work for hopefully the last time, because it is a bit silly, but we give it a try. Right. So let's start off with, if we can, let's capture what he's actually arguing. Because he's not actually arguing that a wealth tax is a brilliant method for raising money for public services. He's actually considering them as an instrument to force the rich to surrender their ownerships of assets, which he believes is a good thing of itself. And his mental model is something like this. It's something like the rich own most of the appreciating assets and their wealth is compounding faster than GDP, or GDP averages. And because wealth is finite, it's not, but he thinks it is. Therefore, the wealthy are going to end up owning everything because wealth is finite, and therefore anyone's gain must therefore be somebody else's loss. And if the rich are the ones gaining, then therefore it must be the poor who are losing as a result. And they then use their gains, the rich, to buy houses and businesses from ordinary people, and ownership therefore will concentrate amongst them. And if you tax them on their wealth, it forces them to sell those assets back to the people that they stole them from. They're then available and ownership is redistributed and, you know, inequality falls and living standards recover and all the rest of it. That's basically his mental model. And he actually says that quite explicitly in the video that I'm sort of linking to here. So, you know, he's not saying, oh, government needs another 20 billion. And this is an efficient way of doing it. He's saying this, the compounding of private wealth is itself the disease that needs to be cured. And he repeatedly talks about things like, oh, the young would never own homes. I mean, yes, that is an issue. It's not caused by this, but yes, that is an issue. And that rich families eventually own everything, inherited fortunes, goes on about that a lot. Asset owners are getting richer while workers are getting poorer. And he wants to prevent that wealth compounding. So let's unpick all of the assumptions that he's making when he's doing this. And the assumption number one is that wealth is fixed. There is a fixed amount of wealth across all of time, and it's simply a question of how it's divvied up. And so, you know, he will say things like, you know, if my wealth goes up 30% while the economy grows at 1%, that must have meant that the 29% has come out the pockets of everybody else. It's completely wrong because he's confusing a stock with a flow, and we will come back into that. But at the moment, I think we're just trying to get his assumptions down. What else is it? He says asset appreciation represents extraction. So if a founder's business grows its valuation by 100 million, as far as he's concerned, that's 100 million that everybody else can no longer consume or possess. I'm very tempted to start dismantling this immediately. I'll try and hold back, and we'll just do his assumptions for now. I must constrain myself. But, you know, but I have to a bit, because asset values can rise for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, future earnings might have increased, or at least the expected future earnings might have increased. The company might have invented something genuinely useful that does genuinely productive new work, or productivity could just improve through better management or something. You know, the risk could decline, the interest rates could decline, investors could revise their expectations. And also, actually, the marginal increase in the last share traded notionally revalues the entire stock. It doesn't actually take money out of anyone else's hands. If I set up Danco, and Danco is sending for £1 a share, and then somebody comes along and buys one share, and that was the last share traded at £2 a share, well, suddenly Danco has doubled in value. But that hasn't come from anywhere else. It's just a notional value of the thing, which would actually be quite difficult to realise. But anyway, fine. He also assumes that all large fortunes are economically equivalent. So he treats, a technology founder, a hereditary land, you know, monopoly, a landed estate, a factory, a property portfolio, a private medical company, financial assets, intellectual property, farms. Well, he treats all of them as effectively being the same thing, as manifestation of the same thing, rich people just hoarding assets. He also assumes that forced selling would democratize ownership. If you force people to sell things, you know, the guy around the corner is going to buy them. The kids that he grew up with are going to buy them. People who watch his videos are going to buy them. But those are the people who don't invest because they don't have any savings and they have expensive rent. They typically have, you know, weak incomes, poor access to capital, all that kind of thing. The natural buyers are actually things like pension funds and private equity funds and sovereign wealth funds and foreign billionaires and insurance corporations and tax-exempt institutions, stuff like that. They would actually be the natural buyers, and actually, in his case, it would be foreign buyers coming in, buying up cheap assets. His next assumption, what we're on now, assumption five maybe, is that rich people are entirely passive while being taxed. He assumes that the state imposes a 2% wealth tax, and everything else remains unchanged. No wealthy people change their residency or citizenship or ownership structures or leverage or asset allocation or company domicile or their dividend policy or their investment timescale or trust arrangements or declared valuation. None of that. He doesn't think any of that's going to happen. Assumption six, he assumes that 2% is actually a small tax because he compares it to 40% income tax and therefore 2% must be a low number. But in investment returns, when you're comparing it to investment returns, it's actually a huge number. So it's 20% of a 10% return. If you get a 10% return on your investments, that's a 10% return. And 10% return, that is very, very good. He must imagine that all returns are like crypto during a bull cycle. Actually, 10% is a blowout return if you get that on your investments. But what if your investment return is 5%, which is actually more normal? In fact, 5% is a decent return for investments. An annual return. Well, now it's 40% of that. So straight away we're back at income tax levels, and that's a good return, 5%. What if it's 3%? Well, that's 67% of your return. What if you make a 2% return, which is actually historically quite normal for investments to get around 2%? Well, he's taxing all of it, 100%. So it's not a small amount. Assumption seven, wealth can be objectively measured every year. He's talking about this stuff like everybody just walks around with a number printed above their head or something. But, you know, much of this wealth that he's going to try and be taxing is in private companies that don't have a valuation attached to them. And it's actually incredibly difficult to get that valuation. What about minority stakes in businesses where you don't have control? What about trusts or complex property situations or farms or patents, brands, partnerships, intellectual property? Let's say I've written a manuscript. What are you going to tax me on it? It might be a bestseller, might not be. Let's say I buy the rights to something. some brand, what's that worth? I mean, good luck trying to value all this stuff. Next assumption, must be 8 by now, he assumes that capital can't escape. He assumes that he doesn't need capital controls that shut off and change all of his other assumptions. He assumes that, yeah, wealth can't just leave, but it can. Also, it doesn't solve the problem of, well, reduced inward investment, which would dry up in this situation. He doesn't factor in entrepreneurs choosing another country to set up their business, or new companies, you know, reincorporating themselves abroad, or foreign investors avoiding Britain, or heirs to estates changing their residency before inheritance kicks in, or wealth taxes kick in. He doesn't acknowledge that ownership would presumably fairly rapidly at first and then slow down, but be a continual process of shifting outside the jurisdiction. I think that's all of his assumptions. Well, that's all his worst assumptions anyway. Let's get into how wealth does not work the way that Gary thinks it works. So stock versus flow. This is the first one. GDP measures the value of goods and services produced during a period. And wealth measures the total value of assets at any given point in time. So imagine a company is earning, I don't know, 10 million annually. One multiple of that might decide that the company is therefore worth 100 million, put it on a 10x valuation. Now, if investors become more optimistic, they might put a 20x valuation on it, in which case it's now worth 200 million. But that 100 million hasn't come from anywhere. The future expectations of the value of that business has changed, but that 100 million addition to 200 million, that's just a notional value. And so when he says things like, oh, the wealth of these people have gone up 30%, but domestic product has only gone up 1%. Yeah, because one is reality that goods and services produced during that period are that much. And the other one is, what do we think this thing might be worth if we apply some set of valuation criteria to it? To break this down, this is a bit like saying that, I don't know, the value of my house went up 10% this year, but my salary only rose 2% this year. Therefore, I must have made the difference from somebody else's salary. It simply doesn't work that way. This is a very fundamental mistake. All of his mistakes are fundamental. But I mean, confusing stock with flow, assets with income, they're not the same thing. And he doesn't get it right. Your house going up does not mean you've stolen somebody else's salary. It doesn't work like that. And then there's a marginal price problem, okay? So an investor purchases 1% of a startup for 1 million because he's really optimistic about what the startup can do. And that implies the startup is worth 100 million. And so the founder, who owns 70% of this business, is now notionally worth 70 million. But that company doesn't have 70 million in the bank. It might only have 1 million in the bank, the 1 million that it's just got for selling 1% of its shares. The many shares haven't been sold. And so what, you're going to tax him 2% of 70 million? He hasn't got it. He can't pay that. That's not viable. And actually, Daniel, whatever his name is, in the video, he explains this fairly well. You know, slight variations in startups' valuation criteria could easily push 2% of the notional value of the business well beyond its cash reserves. Wealth creation versus wealth transfer. A good productive company can create wealth in a whole number of different ways. You know, it can lower prices, it can increase outputs, it can save people time, it can, you know, create new technologies or something. If AI is a good example. I mean, if I invented tech that let you live to 150, would that be valuable? Would people be willing to pay for it? I think they would. Or what about if it wasn't even that? What if I found a way to save money? What if I found a way of radically simplifying some important logistic process that everybody has to endure this thing? Maybe I invent a robot that will do the laundry for you, or some other aspect of things. I'm creating productivity. You now no longer need to do your laundry or cook your dinners or whatever it is, and therefore you get more time to work doing whatever it is you do. I've massively increased planetary productivity. Wealth has been genuinely created. He can't get his head around that. He thinks it's all zero sum. And he doesn't acknowledge, you know, the negative form of accumulation on the other side of that either. You know, he doesn't acknowledge that land prices are largely a function of planning restrictions. Or, you know, a lot of businesses exist due to regulatory monopolies, making it very difficult for new businesses to come in, or government licenses, or bailouts, or politically connected contracts for those business, or artificial scarcity, or financial privilege of some sort, or monetary inflation as a result of government overspending, or extraction from consumers. He doesn't acknowledge any of this stuff, but the distinction is important. The distinction isn't between wealthy and non-wealthy. The difference is between productive wealth and rent extraction.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.